The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reader Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. And welcome to November. We will start Your True Stories, Adventures in Babysitting. Treasured memories from modern-day Mary Poppinses and Daffy but dear Mrs. Doubtfires. Asking the right questions. A friend was babysitting for five kids and found crayon scribbles all over the wall. He knew the culprit wouldn't go down easy, so he cleverly asked, "Who drew those beautiful pictures on the wall?" Of course, the guilty party announced, "I did!" Dropping, then picking up the ball. I babysat my sister and her friend every New Year's. We'd have our own little party with snacks and smarky grape juice. The girls didn't know our time zone was an hour behind New York City, so every year at 11 p.m. we'd watch the ball drop, then they went off to bed, and I was free to watch whatever I wanted. Fortunately, when my sister realized years later, she thought it was funny and clever. That's a young lady from Texas. Bedtime means bedtime. Our parents were going out to dinner with our neighbors, who asked if I could babysit their young kids. They wanted the kids in bed by 8 p.m., which was no problem. When they came home, they found the kids sound asleep but couldn't find me. I'd gone home to bed. My job was done, or so I thought. Jeez. Help yourself. My wife and I left for the evening, telling our babysitter that she could help herself to anything in the fridge. 3 hours later, we came home to a tearful teenager kneeling in front of the open oven door and frantically scraping a mountain of melted plastic from the inside. We left out one crucial instruction. Help yourself, but make sure you remove the Tupperware we store in the oven before firing it up. Tots in the hen house. I was babysitting two high-energy boys for the weekend. By Saturday morning, I was already exhausted, so I took them up on my brother's farm. The boys were entertained for hours chasing chickens. They never caught one and were totally pooped at the end of the evening. Cat's cradle. One of the girls I was babysitting kept crawling under her bed while we played in her room. I thought she was just having fun hiding from us. Later, her mother called to tell me their cat had decided that under the girl's bed was a good place to have kittens. What fun! I couldn't believe I didn't notice it. Twix up the sleeves. Not tricks, Twix, T-W-I-X. I asked the kids I was watching if I was allowed to munch from a candy dish I'd found. They looked at me and asked, "You want some candy?" Then they led me to the basement, which held floor-to-ceiling shelves of candy bars of all varieties. Apparently, their father was a Mars Candy Company salesman. It was a dream gig. Not only were the kids good, but also I could eat candy to my heart's content. Fake it or make it. I was 12 years old and doing a lot of babysitting. Once I was left in charge of four kids. I asked them all their names and ages. Imagine my surprise, the firstborn was a year older than me. I was tall for her age and she was short, so I didn't tell them I was actually their big sister's junior. A dark and humid night. We left our little girls with a babysitter and returned home to a pitch-black house. We opened the door and heard three big sighs of release. The house was stifling. It was obvious the air conditioner wasn't working either. Apparently we'd lost power on this hot summer night. The girls couldn't find a flashlight, so they sat in total darkness with the door and windows closed, clinging to our poor teenage babysitter. She practically had to peel the sticky, sweaty girls from each side. We all laugh about it still years later. We attended the babysitter's baby shower and gifted her a heavy-duty flashlight. Very dog-friendly neighborhood. My dog Cooper would hang out on the porch every time I babysat my neighbor. One day the kid let Copper inside. "I don't think your boys want Copper in here," I told him. "It's fine. Mom does it all the time," he replied. I didn't believe him and asked his mother when she got home. "Oh, no, I really do," she said. "He stops by every morning and I let him finish the leftover cat food." Copper was on a diet, so I asked her not to feed him. "You'll need to tell that to the Smiths, the Joneses, and Mrs. Evans. She keeps biscuits on her just for him," she informed me. A smart dog. Holy fright. I heard a late-night knock on the door long after I'd put the kids I was babysitting to bed. A man said he was my employer's brother, but I hadn't been told to expect any visitors, and I could barely see his face through the peephole. I made him wait on the porch. Much to my relief, the parents arrived soon after, letting the man in with them. I was so embarrassed. He was indeed the kid's uncle, and more than that, a priest. I hadn't been able to see his collar in the dark. I got an extra tip as the father walked me home and thanked for being such a cautious babysitter. How I tried to stop snoring. I wanted a quick fix, even if it meant strapping a glorified bike pump to my face. I think of myself as a good sleeper. Give me a book in a horizontal position, and I could fall asleep strapped to the top of a bullet train. Sleep has been a constant ally, a friend. When I was a teen, it was a refuge I used to pray for sleep. Its temporary oblivion was a welcome respite from the anxiety and obsessive thoughts. It was a pause. Not a death, but close enough to it. Every time I fell asleep, there was a chance of resurrection to wake up new and refreshed. My girlfriend Allison, however, does not think I'm a good sleeper. She knows the truth. At night, I thrash around and scream. Occasionally, it sounds as if my breathing stops. Worst of all for her, I snore. Badly. She showed me a video of it, and it's horrifying. My thin, wheezing inhalations are interrupted by a wrenching tear of noise, like someone ripping a carpet inside a cave. It sounds like a Hans Zimmer score. It's awful. We sometimes get into little fights when I wake up. She has had a terrible sleep, flipping my sleeping body over and plugging my nose, or occasionally smothering my face with a pillow, and is justifiably annoyed. She can't stay mad for long, though, because who is she mad at? Certainly if it was my body, not me, it was snoring. My lungs moving the air, my soft tissues, those are the guilty parties. I wasn't even there. I tried treating my story with a junk drawer solution of purchasing every anti-snoring device available. Nose strips, mouth guards, nasal spray, anything that promised snoring absolution. Nothing worked. Every time, there would be a glimmer of hope when we would try to convince ourselves my snoring was better. But every time, it soon became clear the only difference was that the top of my mouth was now shredded from the cheap plastic of the snow-called snow-guard. Allison wanted me to see a doctor. But it's hard to take snoring seriously. It seems more like a joke, like a problem that a sitcom dad would have after getting electrocuted by Christmas decorations. It seems less like a health issue and more like a personality defect. Snoring occurs as our muscles in the upper airway relax so much that they narrow the airway, says Nick Van Berg, a Ph.D. candidate in experimental psychology at the University of Ottawa and a member of the Canadian Sleep Society, a group of professionals dedicated to improving sleep quality. This is why snoring gets worse as we age, as our once taut and viral inner neck muscles become flabby and weak. The real threat of bad snoring is it could be a sign of obstructive sleep apnea, when a blockage in your airway causes you to wake up constantly. The lack of sleep for you or your partner can be a serious health risk, as insufficient sleep is linked to heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and Alzheimer's. More than the health issues, sleep is essential to your functioning as a human being. Sleep is key to memory consolidation, says Vanderberg. When we sleep, our brain organizes, processes, and saves our memories. More than that, he says, sleep also enhances our memories. Vanderberg told me about studies in which subjects are taught a basic skill before bed, and when they wake up, they not only remember the skill, but also have actually improved upon it. Sleep, then, is where we are forged. Every night we throw our day-to-day experiences, memories, and lessons into the kiln of sleep. Let them bake for 8 hours, ideally, and remove a better, stronger, and fuller version of ourselves in the morning. So my girlfriend was right to insist that I deal with the problem, but I was resistant. I'm in my mid-30s, and I haven't had a doctor since I was a kid. My health care subsidized on walk-in clinic visits and youthful hubris, a faith that things will work out and a belief that problem doesn't really exist until you deal with it. But what really scared me off was that going to a doctor about my snoring could cause me to confront how I live and its repercussions, and that my body has limits, almost like being shown a mirror to my mortality. Certainly not a face-to-face with the Grim Reaper, seeing who would blink first, but definitely footsies. It's been a tough year. A friend passed away suddenly and tragically. Then my grandmother followed. My chronic knee problem turned into a full-blown meniscus tear, dashing any hopes of a late-life bloom into a guy who's surprisingly athletic and revealing a body that is eroding with time. My eyesight became disordered, and the eye doctor told me I had fluid under my retina, a condition called central serous chorionephritis. This is about an 18-letter thing, so forgive me. Cho or Rionanapathy. It's caused by stress. Also, I started seeing a therapist again. Within minutes, over Zoom, he told me I looked depressed. It was a year that the space capsule of my youthful fantasy broke up on contact with an atmosphere of reality and repercussions, all soundtracked by some of the worst snoring you've ever heard. But there are things to be afraid of, besides aging. And so fearing a breakup or an unexplained disappearance, mine, I tried what Allison had been asking me to do. I went to a doctor. The doctor asked me how many alcoholic drinks I drank a week. I gave him a number that was high enough for me to know he should factor it into his diagnosis, but low enough that I could say it without being embarrassed. He said that it was likely I had sleep apnea, and that I should drink less and lose weight. He referred me to a sleep study to confirm the diagnosis. To help with sleep apnea, I need a CPAP, a continuous positive airway pressure machine. And to get the machine, I need to study the results. A CPAP machine suits a steady flow of pressurized air into your nose and mouth. It involves a hose, a mask that covers either your nose or mouth or both, and a head harness, resulting in the wearer looking like a cozy fighter pilot, like Top Gun's Maverick of undisclosed enemy country were your dreams. I entered the hospital sleep clinic, ready to get my sleep on. I felt nervous and excited and blisteringly sober. I successfully adhered to the guidelines sent out by the clinic. No alcohol in the past 12 hours, no coffee in the last two, no naps, free from a chooser coating of hangover, too late coffee, and post-nap delirium. My mind was an unadored and hungry for answers. A technician asked me a couple of questions, the most provocative being, what position do you sleep in? I'm mostly a mix of side and stomach, with one leg pitched as if I'm doing a hurdle. Overall, though, I've described my sleeping position as maximum obnoxious. My limbs are splayed as far as it can reach, and I continually thrash and roll from side to side in erratic and irregular movements. Basically, I sleep the way David Byrne dances. I sat on my assigned bed, waiting for the sleep lab to begin its work. Lab was a misnomer. There were no beakers or mad scientists or stainless steel tanks with anonymous figures floating in green fluid. It's just a generic hospital room, infinite white walls, a thin, hard bed that made me feel as if I were lying on an H.M. clothing shelf, and a pillow that had all the comfort and support of a bag of napkins. Worst of all, something was dripping into an A.C. unit, producing a sharp, rhythmic, metallic smack. At 10:45 p.m., the technician began sticking electrodes on my body. For the electroencephalogram, or EEG, this test measures brain waves without being invasive, cutting your head open. Created in 1904, it is still the gold standard for sleep studies. The technician also placed sensor on my arms and legs to measure my movement, and a sensor below my nose and a harness around my chest to measure my breathing. I have done a sleep test. Let me tell you, that sucker is not fun. I don't know what it says about my self-esteem, but I found being a specimen thrilling. The thrill quickly passed as I proceeded to have the worst sleep of my life. I did the same with me. There are two types of sleep. NREM and REM. Both are required for memory consolidation. NREM, non-rapid eye movement, sleep has three stages. Stage one is drifting off. Those 5 to 10 minutes of drowsiness where it is hard to tell if you are asleep or not. Once you are out, the second stage begins. It is marked by slower brain waves and short, fast bursts of brain activity called spindles. The third stage of NREM, is slow wave sleep. Your brain waves are now deep, long curves, similar at times to those seen in people under anesthesia. It is in these last two stages of NREM sleep that the body repairs itself on cellular level from the wear and tear of the day. Suddenly, the second act of sleep begins, REM, rapid eye movement. The brain explodes with activity, it appears awake. This is when most dreaming occurs, especially the intense emotional genre of dreams, the ones that are like, I bought a date, but there's a book report I didn't finish, or, I started playing hockey again, but I didn't realize that my skates are made of everyone I've disappointed. Your heart races, and beneath your eyelids, your eyes start to dart around wildly. It's not entirely clear why this happens. Van der Berg's favorite theory is that it's preparatory. As he puts it, if NREM is recovery from the day before, REM seems to be preparation for the day ahead. When you have a good night's sleep, these different stages are a harmonious repeating cycle. Of course, many things can disrupt this harmony. Electric light, caffeine, a late night out, or, as I found out, being covered in wires that precariously cling to your body with every toss and turn. Many thoughts can keep you up at night, and in the lab I discovered a new one. I sure hope that when I turned over, I didn't ruin this experiment being performed on me. Another pressure point in the delicate dance of the sleep stages is if there is unceasing arrhythmic dip in the air conditioning unit the entire night. I was woken up at 5:30 a.m. after maybe 2 hours of gruel-thin snoozing. The wires were removed and I strolled home in the dawn light, feeling as if my sleep-wake cycle and circadian rhythms were utterly and completely ruined. After 2 months, the results of the study came in. It said I do not have sleep apnea. I have mild primary snoring. I have, as far as the study could tell, there was no particular reason for it. Aging, drinking too much, and rapidly deteriorating neck muscles are all it takes. The snoring was simply the sound of time catching up to me. These were not the results I was looking for. I had been hoping for a condition, a disorder, something to point to whenever I indulged in a self-pity wallow. I wanted a quick fix, even if it meant strapping a glorified bike pump to my face. Instead, what I got were consequences which coalesce and compound and reverberate, like a snore off the inner walls of your throat. There is no guarantee things will just work out. Injuries worsen, tragedy happens, your girlfriend gets fed up you snoring, and when you don't sleep, it takes days to recover. My snoring has gotten worse since the study, louder, more frequent. Thankfully, my girlfriend and I have figured out a staggered sleep schedule that seems to work. Also, I'm working out more, eating better, and drinking less, because from this study I learned that you are an accumulation of everything you did before. Things are just going to get better on their own. You had better take care of yourself and others. When you ate, what you learned, how you slept, these things matter. The person you are today builds from the person you were the day before. Oh, the unexciting places you'll go. Boring, Oregon, and Dahl, Scotland, are sister cities. In 2017, they added Blanshire, Australia, to their League of Extraordinary Communities. Nightmare at Night, the nightclub. When the shooting started, a combat veteran's life-saving instincts kicked in. And there's a picture of people crouching and flowing on the floor. It's all a painting. It's not an actual picture. And there's a picture of the gentleman, Army veteran Richard Fierro. He's got a goatee and a mustache. He's partially bald. Richard M. Fierro was at table at Club Q with his wife, daughter, and friends on a Saturday night last November when suddenly a flash of gunfire ripped across the nightclub. His instinct, forced during 4 combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan, instantly kicked in. Fight back, he told himself. Protect your people. Fierro, 45, who spent almost 50 years as an Army officer and left as a major in 2013, charged through the chaos and tackled the gunman, beating him bloody with the shooter's own gun. Good for him! I don't know exactly what I did. I just went into combat mode, Fierro said in the driveway of his Colorado Springs, Colorado home, just days after the shooting, an American flag hanging limp in the freezing air. I just knew I had to kill this guy before he killed us. Anderson Lee Aldrich, then 22, was arrested on charges of killing 5 people and wounding 18 more. 4 others were also injured in a rampage that lasted only a few minutes. The death toll could have been much higher, officials said, if persons of the bar had not stopped the shooter. He saved a lot of lives, John Struthers, then mayor of Colorado Springs, said of Fierro. Sutter said he had spoken to Fierro and was struck by his humility. I have never encountered a person who engaged in such heroic action and was so humble about it. It was supposed to be a chill family night out. The combat veteran, his wife, Jess Fierro, joined their daughter, Cassandra, her longtime boyfriend, Raymond Green Vance, and 2 family friends. It was Fierro's first time at a drag show, and he was digging it. After all those years in the Army, he now relished his role as a civilian and a father, watching one of his daughter's old high school friends perform. These kids want to live that way, want to have a good time and have at it, he said as he described the night. I'm happy about it, because that's what I fought for, so they can do whatever the hell they want. Fierro was trying to get better at going out. In Iraq and Afghanistan, he'd been shot at, seen roadside bombs, shred trucks in his platoon, lost friends. He was twice rewarded the Bronze Star. The wars were both past and still present. There were things he would never forget. For a long time after he came home, crowds put him on edge. He couldn't help but be vigilant. In restaurants, he sat against the wall facing the door. No matter how much he tried to relax, part of him was always ready for an attack, like an itch that could not be scratched. He was too often distrustful, quick to anger. It had been hard on his wife and daughter, and he was working on it. There was medication, and there were sessions with a psychologist. He got rid of all the guns in the house. He grew his hair out long and grew a long white goatee to distance himself from his days in uniform. He and his wife owned a successful local brewery called Atrevida Beer Company, and he had a warm relationship with his daughter and her longtime boyfriend. He also accepted that war would always be with him. But that night at Club Q, he was not thinking of war at all. The women were dancing, he was joking with his friends, then the shooting started. It was a staccato of flashes by the front door, the familiar sound of small arms fire. Fierro knew it too well. Without thinking, he hit the floor, pulling his friend down with him. Bullets sprayed across the bar, smashing bottles and glasses. People screamed. Fierro looked up and saw a figure as big as a bear, easily more than 300 pounds, wearing body armor and carrying a rifle a lot like the one he had carried in Iraq. The shooter was moving through the bar toward a door leading to a patio where dozens of people had fled. The long-suppressed instinct of a platoon leader surged back to life. Fierro raced across the room, grabbed the gunman by a handle on the back of his body armor, and pulled him to the floor and jumped on top of him. Was he shooting at the time? Was he about to shoot? I don't know, Fierro said. I just knew I had to take him down. The two crashed to the floor. The gunman's military-style rifle clattered just out of reach. Fierro started to go for it, but then saw the gunman come up with a pistol in his other hand. I grabbed the gun out of his hand and just started hitting him in the head over and over, said Fierro. As he held the man down and slammed the pistol down in his skull, Fierro started barking orders, using a string of explicatives. He yelled for another club patron to grab the rifle. Then he told the patron to start ticking the gunman in the face. A dancer was passing fire, and Fierro ordered her to stop the attacker with her high heels. The whole time, Fierro said, he kept pummeling the shooter with the pistol while screaming at him. What allowed him to throw aside all fear and act? He said he has no idea. Probably this old instinct of war, which had burdened him for so long at home, suddenly had a place now. Something like war had come to his hometown. In combat, most of the time, nothing happens. But it's that mad minute when you are tested in that minute, it becomes habit, he said. I don't know how I got the weapon away from that guy. No idea. I'm just a dude. I'm fat old vet, but I knew I had to do something. When police arrived a few minutes later, the gunman was no longer struggling. Fierro himself, covered in blood, feared that he had killed him. Fierro got up and frantically lurched around in the dark and looking for his family. He sprawled his friends on the floor. One had been shot several times in the chest and arm. Another had been shot in the leg. As more police filed in, Fierro started yelling as they were back in combat. Casualties! Casualties! I need a medic here, now! He yelled to the police that the scene was clear. The shooter was down, but people needed help. He took tourniquets from a young police officer and put them on his bleeding friends. He tried to speak calmly to them as he worked, telling them they would be okay. He spied his wife and daughter on the edge of the room and was about to go to them when he was tackled. Officers rushing him into the chaotic scene had spotted him, a blood-spattered man with a handgun. Not knowing whether he was a threat, they put Fierro in handcuffs and locked him in the back of a police car for what seemed like more than an hour. He screamed and pleaded to be let go so that he could see his family. Eventually, Fierro was freed. He located his wife and daughter, both of whom had minor injuries, and went to the hospital with them. His friends were there in much more serious condition, but thankfully they were all alive. But his daughter's boyfriend was nowhere to be found. In the dark and disarray, they had lost him. They drove back to the club searching for him. They circled familiar streets, hoping they would find him walking home, but there was no sign of him. Then the family got a call late Sunday from the young man's mother. He had died in the shooting. When Fierro heard, he said he held his daughter and cried. In part, he cried because he knew what lay ahead. The families of the dead, the people who were shot, had now been in war, as he had. They would struggle as he and so many of his combat buddies had. They would ache with misplaced vigilance. They would lash out in anger, never able to scratch the edge of fear, torn by the longing to forget and urge to always remember. My little girl, she screamed, and I was crying with her, he said. Driving home from the hospital, I told them, look, I've gone through this before, and downrange, when this happens, you just get out of the next patrol. You need to get out of your mind. That is how you cured it. You cured it by doing more. Eventually, you get home safe. But here I worry there is no next patrol. It's harder to cure. You're already home. Editor's note. On June 26, Anderson Lee Aldridge pleaded guilty to 5 counts of murder in the first degree, 46 counts of attempted murder in the first degree, and no contest to do bias-motivated crimes. Aldridge received 5 consecutive life sentences without possibility of parole and 46 consecutive 48-year sentences. Now something a little more upbeat. Falling into fall. Embrace the uncertainty of this crisp, colorful season of change. Whether you like it or not, fall is here. Soon the weather will get colder, and the leaves will die, and the nights will stretch longer, and then the days another year is dying. That's just how it goes. At least, that's the way autumn often is cast, in a time of aging and decay. William Shakespeare called it death's second self, when youth burns to ashes. More recently, it's become a time to acknowledge our existential dread. For many of those who struggle with seasonal depression in the winter months, fall is the beginning of their symptoms. A few small studies even suggest that if you are ruminative or deeply preoccupied with your thoughts in the autumn, you may be more at risk for depression in the winter. Changing the clocks in the fall is associated with depressive episodes. Changing them back in the spring is not. It's no wonder the season has so many celebrations to attempt to keep our spirits up. Psychologists say that the feelings that often crop up in autumn stem from our discomfort with change and anxiety and uncertainty about what that change will bring. The melancholy we feel is a form of grief. The morning's lost sunlight, the ease of summertime, and the greenery that abounds in the warm weather. But it's not all bad. Fall also brings with it bright bis days, pumpkin patches, and cozy sweaters and pumpkin spice. Summer in the crunching leaves, crackling fires, and chilly air. You might even locate a feeling of possibility, even electricity. And all these things, the anxiety, the promise, and even the rumination, make it the ideal season to build resilience and practice mindfulness. A season of resilience. For Jelena Kekamanovic, founder of Arlington, D.C. Behavior Therapy Institute, the fall is reminiscent of exploring the mountains near her former home in Sarajevo, in what was then Yugoslavia. She spent the first 20 years of her life there during one of that country's most prosperous eras. But in the 1990s, she was forced to flee during a bloody four-year siege of her city. Today, she's an expert in resilience, a concept centering on the capacity to adapt to challenging life experiences. Kekamanovic describes autumn as a season we can work on our acceptance of uncertainty, embracing that unsettled feeling we may have as we move out of our warm weather routines. Psychologists have found that the thought of change underlies a great deal of anxiety. Some of us struggle with intolerance and uncertainty, as experts call it, more than others. This tendency was first named in the 1990s by a team of Canadian psychologists and has since been identified as a risk factor for poor mental health. A fascinating amount of research has been showing that intolerance for distress, for discomfort, for impermanence, for uncertainty predicts bad outcomes in the long run, Kekamanovic says. But intolerance of uncertainty is a part of being human. Everyone has it on some level, and it's changeable. One way to build tolerance is to lean into it, to cultivate uncertainty rather than run away from it. The avoidance of suffering produces suffering, says Kelly Wilson, an emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Mississippi. A feeling of exhilaration can also come from experiencing something new or uncertain, which in turn builds resilience, Kekamanovic says. Leaning into uncertainty means putting aside your routines and your planning, which Kekamanovic calls cushions that make us feel like we have control. Bike through a neighborhood you've never been to without a map. Set out during one of these lengthening autumn nights to find somewhere dark enough to do some stargazing. Go for a walk on a day when it just might rain. You might get lost or soak or be unable to see any stars. You might feel uncomfortable as you're wasting your time. But those small moments of uncertainty, Kamanovic says, will build exposure to a tolerance toward and perhaps even an appreciation of times when you don't know what's ahead and feel out of control. It's the opposite of, I have assurance how it's going to be in the next half hour, or the next day, or the next year, she says. It's like, in this moment, I'm alive, and that's enough. A season of mindfulness. There are quieter ways as well to engage with the changing of the seasons. Another strategy that experts suggest for soothing seasonal anxiety is to step back and simply observe the world around you. Quietly sit on a park bench and watch three raindrops leaves, for instance. Kekamanovic says that weaving bigger themes of nature and purpose into quiet moments of meditation can help calm your sense of anxiety around short-term uncertainty and put it into a broader perspective. For Jana Long, co-founder of the Black Yoga Teachers Alliance in Baltimore, fall is time for samyama, a concept in yoga referring to, among other things, the meditative practice of observing an object and becoming absorbed in it. Sometimes Long looks at the grass after the final mowing of the year and spends some time thinking about what it means for a plant. Other times, she says, she examines the roses in her garden that need pruning before winter, imagining that need, imagine what they need and how they will change. She says in such moments it's important to stop thinking, analyzing, or having internal conversations about work or troubles or even whatever you're witnessing. A teacher once demonstrated this idea to her by placing a glass of water on the table. He started by saying he saw the glass. Then he continued to talk about how the mind shifts. I like the glass. See? Now that's something else. And then, I want the glass. That's something else again, she says. But can you just see the glass? That's practicing samyama. This kind of mindfulness has been shown again and again to reduce stress and increase well-being. It can enhance your workouts and help you focus at work and cope with an uncertain world. For some, practice mindfulness can shift how they see their lives in a big way. For most of us, it's a useful tool to find a sense of peace when we need it. It's also perfectly suited for a cool autumn day, when any of the year is in view and the world around you is turning on itself. For me, it's also about harvesting what has occurred in the year, says Larry Ward, a meditation teacher and the founder of the Lotus Institute in Pataskala, Ohio. Oh, I know where that is. What has this summer brought to you in your life? What has this spring brought to you? Harvesting means taking stock of the year or years behind you. And to do this, you must collect memories without judgment or self-loathing. For instance, Wilson of the University of Mississippi says he acted poorly in the last time he saw his brother before his untimely death. But rather than push that memory away, he holds it as part of that relationship. I keep the thorn to keep the rose, he says. That's a great line. Autumn will probably always hold some whisper of decay and mortality for humans. But embracing that sadness is important. You're always trying to avoid difficult feelings. You might end up also cutting yourself off from love and riches and sweetness, Wilson says. This is how life is, sweet and sad, poured from the same vessel in equal measure. As a 90 kids, it blows my mind the most famous Culkin and Olsons are Kieran and Elizabeth. Well, we're switching over to Consumer Reports now. And last week we ended up only partway through lowering your stress when you have to air travel. And the third item, the first two items were, it all starts with the flight you book. And let's see, the second one was stress less at the airport. That includes learning to carry-on bagic basics, expedite the security process, make waiting worthwhile. Number three is enjoy your airtime. First of all, dress for comfort. Travel Pulse's Bowman suggests wearing comfortable athletic shoes. I see people running with flip-flops because they're heading to the beach. But that's not ideal if you have to get from one side of a large airport to the other to make a tight connection, he says. Wilson wears tennis shoes that slip on and off. She also suggests comfortable yoga pants or stretchy jeans, especially important in tight cabin spaces. I wear Figs pants, which are like medical scrub pants that look professional. Plus, I have lots of pockets for your cell phone, even my Kindle, she says. She also suggests carrying a jacket, hoodie, or sweater that you can put on or take off to adjust the plane's temperature. Get some Z's. Wilson brings an eye mask to block light from the windows. Neck pillows and noise-canceling headphones can also help you zone out and get some sleep. Pack carry-on must-haves. Wilson brings her own snacks on every flight, like granola bars, a sandwich, or hummus, and chips, or brie and crackers. If you want to brush your teeth afterward, I like Colgate Wisp, which are like mini travel toothbrushes, Wilson says. Other things brie include tablets or phones loaded with enough downloaded programs to keep you entertained on your flight, plus compatible noise-canceling headphones so that you don't have to rely on the airline's seatback system. And of course, don't forget your chargers. Include an empty water bottle on your carry-on that you can refill after going through security. That way you don't have to rely on those tiny drinks from the beverage cart to get you through a multiple hours flight. And pack small bottles of lotion, eye drops, or nasal spray if you're worried about dry airplane air. Five sticky situations and how to solve them. A passenger asks you to switch seats. It's okay to say no, says travel writer Benet Wilson, except perhaps when parents need to sit with a small child. In other situations, you could politely say something like, I'm terribly sorry, but I need to sleep on this flight and chose a window seat for that reason. However, if you're being asked to swap an equal seat, say an aisle seat for one that's one row back, it's probably pretty nice to agree. You're seated near a crying baby. You have to keep in mind that a child is likely to experience some problem, maybe ear pain or fear, Gottsman says. You can ask the flight attendant if there is a quieter seat available, but there are probably people all around you asking the same thing. This is another situation, she says, where noise-canceling headphones can come in handy. You're allergic to your seatmate's dog. Once a woman behind me had taken her dog out of its case and the animal was hitting my leg, Wilson says. Wilson explained that she was allergic, and the woman indignantly put the bag dog back in its case. I try not to drag the flight attendant into small stuff. I try politely handle it myself, she says. You're near an angry passenger. If someone... Excuse me, that was an interruption there. If someone is being so aggressive that you start to feel concerned or overwhelmed, then call the flight attendant, says Gottsman. They are trained to handle aggressive passengers, and particularly in this part of time, it's become very popular. And they can make decisions you can't make on that plane, like having someone removed if necessary. You're in a seat repeatedly kicked by a child. Gottsman suggests you take a breath and, in a pleasant tone, turn around and say, I know your toddler is young, but he is kicking my seat. Would you mind helping me with that? Wilson has an additional suggestion. Tell the parent one trick that I learned when I was traveling with my child is to take off their shoes off. They don't like to kick in their socks. And ratings. Then they give the ratings to the different airlines, the ones that they feel like are the best thing. And the first two are Hawaiian and Alaska Airlines. So if you live on the West Coast, you've got an advantage the rest of us don't. Breeze Airways, Delta Airlines, Southwest Airlines, Avelio Airlines, and JetBlue Airways get decent marks. Allegiant Airlines, United Airlines, American Airlines, and Sun Country Airlines, so-so. Spirit Airlines and Frontier Airlines get lousy ratings for economy class. Business First Class, once again, Hawaii and Alaskan Airlines are the top two. Delta Airlines, United Airlines, Southwest, American, and JetBlue Airways scored pretty well. And stay connected wherever you're going. Here's a complete guide to getting online when you're not at home. Staying connected, whether you're out for a walk in the park, relaxing in a coffee shop, or sitting on an airplane, seems like it should be easy. After all, cellular networks blanket most of the U.S., and Wi-Fi is now available everywhere from shopping malls to doctor's office to open-air parks. But somehow, using all of these networks isn't as uncomplicated as you'd like it to be. Take public Wi-Fi. Is it safe to connect your phone or laptop to these convenient wireless networks, or will that expose your data to hackers and identity thieves? How to use a hotspot to stream movies on your laptop when you're out of Wi-Fi range? And what do you do when you're headed to a place where there's no cell coverage or internet service at all? We've got all the answers to your most pressing questions that can do. Okay. Before you leave home, the cell coverage you need. To set yourself up to maintain consistent connections, the first step is getting the right cell plan. This is easier to do than it used to be. The three big carriers, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon, now offer comparable coverage in most parts of the U.S., and smaller carriers piggyback off big carrier cell tower networks. But if you regularly experience connection problems in your area, you can check out local coverage maps on your carrier's website to learn whether you're well covered. Do you need to purchase an unlimited data plan or a less expensive limited data plan adequate? It depends on what you use your phone for. You won't use much data if you mostly check email and read news online, for example, and talking and texting doesn't count to a data limit at all. On the other hand, if you frequently stream video or music to your phone or tablet, or use your phone as a Wi-Fi hotspot to get your laptop or tablet connected to the internet, you may go over your limit and get charged extra. But if that happens with any frequency, it may take sense to switch to an unlimited data plan. Pricing varies by carrier, but cell plans with unlimited data generally start around $60 per phone. How to connect using Wi-Fi. While good cellular coverage stretches across most of the U.S., there are advantages to using Wi-Fi rather than cell service when you're out and about. It may work better if you're streaming a video, for one thing, and Wi-Fi is usually the easiest way to get online with a laptop or tablet. Joining a network. Connecting to a public Wi-Fi network is easier regardless of what kind of device you're using. With a laptop, you can find a list of available Wi-Fi networks by clicking on the Wi-Fi logo or select the arched waves radiating upward on the top of the screen for Macs and the bottom of the screen for Windows laptops. Although some Wi-Fi networks don't require a password to join, those that have little lock icon next to them do. The password may be posted conspicuously or available on request from nearby staff. Both Android and Apple phones also easily connect to Wi-Fi. Depending on the model, you'll need to swipe down from the top of the screen or up from the bottom to reveal the Wi-Fi icon, or look under the settings menu. People often ask, which drains your battery faster, a cellular connection or Wi-Fi? According to Richard Fisco, who oversees electronics testing for Consumer Reports, the difference between the two is minor. But if you don't plan to use Wi-Fi at all while on a tour of a city, you can eke out some extra minutes of battery life by temporarily turning off your phone's Wi-Fi connectivity. The reason, when Wi-Fi is turned on, your phone constantly checks to see which Wi-Fi networks are available. Turning off your Wi-Fi connectivity saves the phone from doing that work. But if you're using Wi-Fi, you can extend your battery life a bit by turning off your phone's cellular connection. Either way, swipe up or down for the icons to go, or go to the settings menu to turn them off. And here's a very important question. Is public Wi-Fi safe? Computer security experts used to urge consumers to be cautious when connected to public Wi-Fi networks because there was a risk that the data could be intercepted by hackers or identity thieves. That's less of an issue today, largely because of the use of HTTPS encryption, which scrambles data so hackers can't read it. The technology is now used by most websites, making it safe even to sign into your banking app when you're using public Wi-Fi. I still don't do it. See, our digital security expert, Yale Grauer, says you should make your browser is HTTPS only mode. For detailed instructions, go to cr.org/HTTPS only mode and recommends checking the security of sites you go to. Specifically, look for HTTPS in your browser's address bar, for example. https://www.consumerreports.org or a padlock icon. Either one indicates that the site is protecting your connection using encryption. Using a hotspot, laptop streaming without Wi-Fi. You're in your car or hanging out at a park or somewhere else where there's no Wi-Fi network, but no worries. You can still get online with your tablet or laptop by employing a personal hotspot, which you can access through your smartphone's cellular connection. Both Android and iOS phones offer this feature along with most cell plans. It takes a signal from a nearby cell tower and makes it available to your device via a small Wi-Fi network created by the phone. You then use your laptop to connect. Here's how. For Android phones, swipe down from the top of the screen, tap the hotspot icon. Some phones may require you to use hotspot and tethering within the settings app instead. Add security by requiring a password for other devices to connect. Turn off the hotspot when you're done. For iPhones, go to the Settings app and then tap the Personal Hotspot option, which is near the top of the menu. Then toggle Allow Others to Join. You'll need to use a password to connect your other devices. And remember to turn off your hotspot when not using it. Connect in the air for less. Traveling by air, join the airline's in-flight Wi-Fi network. There's often a fee, but some credit cards include fee or discounted Wi-Fi. The AA Advantage Aviator Red World Elite MasterCard offers up to a $25 credit toward American Airlines in-flight Wi-Fi, for instance. In addition, customers of T-Mobile's Go5G and Go5G Plus plans can get free in-flight Wi-Fi on select airlines. Just know that the in-flight Wi-Fi can be spotty, and you can stay entertained with music and movies you download in advance. When there's zero coverage, cellular coverage may be nearly ubiquitous and Wi-Fi widespread, but you can't get connected everywhere. Perhaps you're out of range when you go for a hike in a wooded area, or you're simply driving down a country road. That means no phone calls, no Spotify, and no ability to look up directions on Google Maps. But if you plan ahead, you can lessen the inconvenience. Many apps let you download content ahead of time in places where you do have a cellular or Wi-Fi coverage. And what if you have an emergency like a car accident in a place with no coverage? If a voice call to 911 doesn't go through, try texting. In some locations, text sometimes go through even with a weak cell signal. If you have an iPhone 14 or an iPhone 14 Pro, and a text to 911 doesn't go through, the phone will allow you to try connecting by satellite, a nice safety feature that may come on more phones in the future. To use it, you simply attempt to call 911, and your phone determines that you're in an area with no cellular or Wi-Fi service. A prompt will appear asking if you want to text local emergency service via satellite. Apple said this feature works best in areas with a clear view of the sky, free from obstructions like thick tree cover. Download before you go. Even if you're going where there's no cellular or Wi-Fi connection, you can still enjoy movies and music by downloading your entertainment ahead of time. This is also useful on airplanes if you don't want to rely on in-flight Wi-Fi. Popular music streaming apps, including Spotify and Apple Music, allow you to download songs to your phone. Video platforms, including Netflix and Disney, let you download select movies and TV shows. Details on what you can download depend on your device. your subscription plan and the type of content you want to download. Instructions on how to download entertainment also vary by app. In the Netflix app, for example, there's often a downloading option right below the play button. Save a map for your drive. Never get lost again. Ever try to call up directions on your phone only to find you don't have cell coverage where you are? Usually your phone uses its cell connection to access maps, but can't if there's no cell tower nearby. The fix. Download the Google map you need ahead of time when you have internet access. Later, when you're out of range, your phone will use signals from GPS satellites to pinpoint your location on the map. This feature will be added to Apple Maps with the release of the iOS 17 this fall and isn't currently available on Waze. Open the Google Maps, type a location into the search bar, and follow those directions. One of the unfortunate things about the electronics these days and the use of computers and such is scamming online. And here's some examples of different scams that you ought to try to, that you have to avoid. The first one is the free trial scam. How it works. You see an internet offer for a free 1 month trial of some amazing product, often a weight loss program or a teeth whitener or some other thing offering incredible results in record time. All you pay is $5.95 for shipping and handling, or so you think. What's really going on? Buried in the fine print, often in a color that washes into the background, are the terms that obligate you to pay $79 to $99 a month in fees, forever. Canceling the subscription can be a beast and can take months. The big pictures. These guys are really shrewd, says Christine Durst, an internet fraud expert, who has consulted with the FBI and the FTC. They know that most people don't read all the fine print before clicking on I agree, and even people who glance at it just look for numbers. So companies spell out the numbers with no dollar signs. Anything that has to do with money or a time frame gets washed into the text. Avoidance maneuver. To avoid this subscription scam, read the fine print on offers and don't believe every testimonial. Also check 10i.com, a search engine that scours the web for identical photos, or do a reverse image search on your own. If that woman with the perfect teeth shows up everywhere, excuse me, I just screwed that up. Unfortunately, using a computer, sometimes when you push the wrong button accidentally, could kind of screw it up. I apologize for that. If that woman with the perfect teeth shows up everywhere promoting different products, you can be fairly certain her testimonial was fictitious. Reputable companies will allow you to cancel. But if you can't get out of a contract, cancel your card immediately, then negotiate a refund. If that doesn't work, appeal to your credit card company. Fake Wi-Fi hotspot scam. How it works. You're sitting in an airport or a coffee shop and you log into the local Wi-Fi. It could be free, or it could resemble a pay service like Bongo Wireless. You connect and everything seems fine. What's really going on? The site looks legitimate, but it's actually an online scam run by a criminal from a hot laptop. He's most likely sitting very close to you, and you have no idea he's mining your computer for banking, credit card, and other password information. If it's a fake pay site, he also gets your credit card info, which he'll then sell to other crooks. It's a big picture. Fake Wi-Fi hotspots are cropping up everywhere, and it can be difficult to tell them from the real thing. It's lucrative and easy to do, says Brian Yoder, a cybersecurity consultant. Criminals duplicate the legitimate website of a Wi-Fi provider like Verizon or AT&T and tweak it so that it sends your information to their laptop. An avoidance maneuver. Make sure you're not set up to connect automatically to non-preferred networks. For PCs, go to Network and Sharing Center at the control panel. Click on the link for the Wi-Fi network you're currently using. A box with a General tab should pop up. Click Wireless Properties, then uncheck the box next to Connect automatically when this network is within range and click OK. For Enable. For Macs, click on the Wi-Fi button in the upper right, click Open Network Preferences, and check Ask to Join New Networks, and limit IP address tracking. Before traveling, it's also a good idea to buy a $20 Visa or MasterCard gift card, so you can purchase airport Wi-Fi access without broadcasting your credit or debit card information. You can also set up an advance account with providers at airports you'll be visiting if your cellular plans allow you to set up your own personal hotspot. Also, this is incredibly important. Don't do any banking or online shopping from public hotspots unless you're certain the network is secure. Look for the HTTPS, which we just talked about, and the URL, or check to the left of the URL in your browser for a small padlock icon. Finally, always be on the lookout for these red flags. And there's a bogus contest scam. This is pretty common. How it works: you get a direct message or a comment on a social media post announcing a contest for a free iPad, a trip to Hawaii, or some expensive prize. The message says, just click on the link to learn more. The scammer will tell you that in order to claim your winnings, you must pay a small fee that they call taxes, shipping and handling charges, or processing fees. What's really going on? This online scam happens mostly on Twitter, but it can happen on any social media or networking site, and even via email or text. It occasionally happens over the phone, and if it does, the caller will ask for your email so they can send a link and you can claim your prize. The link takes your fee for the prize, steals your credit card information, and also downloads a bot, which will let the hacker send spam emails to your account. The big picture: scammers are taking advantage of URL-shortening devices that allow them to create links that look sort of legitimate. When users can't see the actual URL, it's easy for the bad guys to post malicious links. Once you click on the link, you become vulnerable to phishing or malware being spread to your device, Glassberg says. It also takes advantage of your desire to strike it rich. While it may be irresistible to think about sweepstakes winnings that can change your life, you should never wire money, send cash, or pay with a gift cards or cryptocurrency to get your prize. Don't do it, warns the FTC. Scammers use these payments because it's hard to track who the money went to, and it's almost impossible to get your money back. Avoidance maneuver. It's best not to click on links from any strangers, but if your curiosity is getting the best of you, do a little research first. If you're contacted through social media, check out their profile. You can also Google the person's company or name and phone number to see what comes up. If you see the word scam in any of the search results, that's all you need to know. Scareware scam. How it works: a window pops up about a legitimate-sounding antivirus operating program like Antivirus XP 2022 or security tool and says that your machine has been infected with a dangerous bug. You're prompted to click on a link that will run a scan. Of course, the scan finds a virus, and for a fee, typically about $50, the company promises to clean up your computer. Yeah, right. What's really going on? When you click on the link, the sham company installs malware on your computer. No surprise. There will be no cleanup. But the thieves have your credit card number, you're out the money, and your computer is left on life support. The big picture: scareware affects more than 1 million users daily, according to Dave Barkus, Director of Security and Research for McAfee Labs, a producer of antivirus software. This is a very clever trick, he says, because people have been told for the past 20 years to watch out for computer viruses. Avoidance maneuver: when you get a pop-up virus warning, close the window without clicking on any links, and then run a full system scan using legitimate antivirus software. We recommend Norton or McAfee. It's best to stick to name brands for this, as the knockoffs will likely infect your device. The legitimate companies will use clear, calm language, while scam sites are always sounding five alarms. To that point, Norton says to watch out for pop-ups that use lots of exclamation points, tell you to act fast, and are hard to choose. This type of urgency is common, FYI, with other online scams, including some gift card scams. Smishing scam. How it works: you receive a text from your bank or credit card issuer saying there's been a problem and you need to call right away with some account information. They might tell you your account has been compromised and you need to act fast so you don't lose everything. What's really going on? The bank is a scammer who hopes you'll reveal your account information. If you do, you're actually sharing your credit card information to black hat marketers who ring up phony charges. The big picture: welcome to smishing, which stands for SMS phishing, the text message version of the lucrative email scam. Cell phone numbers are easy to track down on the dark web, and smishing messages are much easier to craft and deliver than phishing emails, says Glassberg. They are significantly shorter, they don't require any formatting, and the attacker doesn't have to worry about bypassing spam filters and antivirus protections. Plus, many banks and businesses often text message notification. This scam has the air of legitimacy. Avoidance maneuver: the best course of action when you receive a text message like this is to contact your bank. But be careful not to bust out the telephone number of your bank, says Stephen J.J. Wiseman, a recognized expert in scams, identity theft, and cybersecurity. Some scammers purchase phone numbers similar to those of legitimate banks and credit card companies, hoping they will receive calls from unwary customers who may have merely misdialed the telephone number of their bank or credit card company. Beware of these phone call scams that can steal your money. And there's a charity scam. Of course, you get an email or social media DM with an image of malnourished orphans from a developing nation. Please get what you can today, goes the charity plea. followed by a request for cash. To speed relief efforts, the email recommends sending a Western Union wire transfer as well as detailed personal information, such as your address, Social Security number, and checking account info. Yet, after all, it's for the children. What's really going on? The charity is a scam designed to harvest your cash and banking information. Nothing goes towards helping those in need. Every penny you sent goes to the scammer. Even worse, the scammer now has access to all your personal information. If you don't act quickly, they'll drain your bank accounts, rack up charges on your credit cards, and possibly steal your identity. The big picture. Hackers create a fake personal business and charity accounts on social media to lure their victims. They may use catfishing tactics, fake deals and special offers, or spoof businesses or hijack real accounts through which they spread malicious links, Klassberg says. Phishing attacks are very common on these platforms because people are less vigilant with a message on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn than they are in their email. Plus, the platforms aren't filtering spam or monitoring for malicious links. Avoidance maneuver. Donate only to real charities on their own websites instead of clicking on links and email solicitations. Also be aware that genuine aid organizations will accept donations by credit card or check, and they won't ask for wire transfers, bank account information, or social security numbers. Donations via text message are okay as long as you confirm the number with the organization. How about some humor in uniform before we close out? My colleague at the Defense Language Institute is an elegant middle-aged woman who was born and raised in Russia. Like many Russian women, she likes her fur coats. One day as we left the building where we had trained a select group of military linguists, some strangers noticed my friend's fur and shouted, "What poor creature had to be sacrificed so you could have this fur coat?" My unruffled colleague replied, "My mother-in-law." Who knew? A military working dog is always one rank higher than its handler. Some say the custom was implemented to prevent handlers from mistreating their dogs. Fewer than 100 recipients have been granted the title of Honorary Marine. The list includes Brigadier General Bob Hope, Master Sergeant Bugs Bunny, and Corporal Jim Neighbor, star of the sitcom Gomer Pyle, USMC. The license plate of the Commandant of the Marine Corps reads 1775. The year the Corps was founded. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week's, and thanks so very much for listening.